is the difference between working in your business and working on your business, right? I want you to work on your partnership. So let's step outside of it and analyze it and talk about it. The fascinating thing about people is we continue evolving and changing, as do businesses. And so it's not just like, oh, I have this insight about myself or my partner, therefore all good and I know exactly what to do. It's checking back in, because we need to continue updating the way that we think about ourselves and we think about the other person. Because if you don't contain conflict, it will contaminate your execution.
You're listening to Contract Revolution, the podcast by Breakthrough Academy, where we systemize contracting businesses for growth. Keep listening to learn how the world's top contractors scale their companies, build killer teams, and make more while working less. Dr. Matt Jones, thank you, sir, for coming on this podcast with us.
You're welcome. I'm excited to chat.
We are going to get into a very spicy topic, co-founder conflict, co-founder relationships, all things around co-founders. And I love it. I have two co-founders myself I work with, one of three in BTA. I find in the membership, it's always a big thing when we see somebody coming in with a business partner, how that dynamic works. And that'll make or break often their ability to even do Breakthrough Academy. So I'm stoked for this conversation. You are in a very niched thing. I've not met someone who niches down into this in the past or before. And I would just love to know how did you get into co-founder relationships, at managing co-founder conflict? How did you find this niche?
Sure. I mean, I stumbled in here like most of us. For me, I was getting my doctorate in clinical psychology. Two of my closest friends started a company together, and I watched them grow it into a multi-million-dollar success externally. But internally, as you know, it was a little bit of a different story. So they had a lot of frustrations with one another. They came to me and were venting quite a bit about some of those ups and downs. And at a certain point, I said, look, guys, the problem's not internal. It's interpersonal. So what we need to do is, instead of you guys triangulating with me, we need to sit down and have a group level conversation. And fast forward a few years, they said, Matt, you not only saved our business, you saved our friendship. So this is whenever I was instantly hooked, because I realized, okay, what's obvious to me is that we have all these tools and frameworks and systems theories and couples therapy modalities that we know work for interpersonal dynamics, even complex and challenging ones. But no one's applying that to startup companies and business partners and co-founders, which at least on the outside looking in, seems like the most important relationship in business, that if you get it right, it kind of sets the cultural floor and ceiling, you know, and your team's execution as well. And on the flip side, what I've seen both personally in this story and then with countless other teams, is that if you get it wrong, then you're up late at night thinking about an argument with your co-founder instead of the business. And I think in that way, it's actually an existential threat to the company's success. And so that's whenever I was like, okay, wait a minute, this is obvious. I'm really excited and would love to keep doing this for the rest of my life.
I don't know anyone else who does this. Is this a field? Do you know others that do this? Like, how come this isn't a thing? Do you know other people who do this?
Thankfully, yes. I mean, so this is part of what's been really fascinating to watch develop. Whenever I started 6 years ago, I thought I was the only person on the planet doing this, which is hilarious in retrospect. But there were only about six people that I could find at that time who did this at all to any extent, not people who just said, this is the one thing that I'm the best in the world at. So very, very small. As things have progressed, I've now connected with about 30 coaches internationally who have this as a specialty. And so the thing that's really unique as a field, as co-founder coaching continues growing as a category, is that we all specialize in different elements of the relationship. So I have a really good colleague and friend who will start with like very young teams, having those essential conversations to set them up for long-term success. Whereas I tend to jump in once there's already a little bit of friction and try to diagnose what's going on and improve it. And then there's other people who bring in tools like the Enneagram to help kind of explain some of those interpersonal dynamics. And so it's something that is small, but I'm excited to see it continue growing.
Yeah, I'm surprised it's so small, because I look at it as almost as much as a marriage, right? Like, I am married, I have kids, I have two co-founders I work with in Breakthrough Academy, and I feel like our kid is the company. And I feel like the level of seriousness, the level of responsibility, the level of passion and commitment that we give to this is close to being married, actually, in a lot of ways. And I don't know if people fully see that, especially when they're first getting into business with someone. Because I work with so many entrepreneurs. I see the beginning, the middle, and the end. You probably do too. And there's always the like, I would love to just like have my buddy work with me. And I'm like, oh my God, we need to talk. So Anyways, let's get into this. So today I thought I would just kind of frame the conversation around like pre-partnership agreements, understanding conflict, getting into how to navigate it well, some unique situations, which I've seen, I'm sure you have too, and just see if we can unravel this, unmythify this, and bring some structure for people who have co-founders or have business partners they work with and help them out. So let's start with the beginning, which is this like, I call it like uninformed optimism stage. It's like, we're going to get in business together. It's going to be amazing. What could possibly go wrong? What are some of the biggest blind spots you see when people are first selecting a partner?
There's so many. I mean, I think to your point, part of just to back up for a second, part of this field that is so interesting is there is a degree of personal naivety or ignorance of just how challenging it is to be in a long-term committed relationship with a business partner where you are going through so many different ups and downs. And so I'll never forget this story where I worked with a VC firm to, as part of their offsite, do a co-founder track. And it was a group that contained both first-time founders and you know, serial entrepreneurs. The thing that was fascinating was as I was having conversations about the importance of managing this relationship, the seasoned entrepreneurs were like, yeah, like we get it. You don't have to explain the value. Like it's obvious. Like, yeah, this is really hard. The first time founders were like, what are you talking about? Mm-hmm. Like, how could we even disagree on what's in the best interest of the company? My co-founder and I are good friends. We're always aligned. Like in what world? It just was a totally foreign concept. And that blew my mind. And so to illustrate the point, we were outside. I kind of drew like a six. I had someone sitting across from me. I was like, what number is it? They're like, Matt, it's a nine. I was like, no, it's a six. And just to demonstrate, we can look at the same piece of information, but depending on our perspectives, we can interpret it quite differently. And so I think there's this whole kind of myth about getting into business with someone where you might think from a business perspective, perhaps strategically, oh, this person could be a good fit. And I'll just give you a brief example here. In a team I'm working with presently, the CEO was going to work with a CTO and was already kind of planning to move forward, but realized, hey, actually, we don't have a lot of exposure to the venture side of things. We've both done a lot of amazing startups previously. They were all bootstrapped. We need somebody to help us fundraise. So they brought in another co-founder. It seemed like a nice enough guy, had some of the network effects that would be beneficial. And now as they've gone into business, they've discovered that their lived values are quite different than their aspirational values. So they all align on the aspirational values of how they want to conduct themselves professionally and culturally. Okay. But this individual does not fit the mold. And so now we're kind of dealing with that friction. And so I bring this up as one category where whether it's thinking someone's going to be a benefit to the business, but we don't really know them, or on the opposite side, we really deeply know somebody in a personal context, and therefore we assume in the professional one, it's going to be smooth swimming. Either way, there's a lot of gaps and a lot of information that we actually need to go back and get both preventatively and then as we continue evolving as a partnership.
When you say lived and aspirational, are you kind of saying there's like the way I conduct myself as a business person and then the way I conduct myself as a person, like my values, and they can be different actually. So like if I show up in business, hey, I've worked with you. I know how you work. We're great. Let's go do it. But hey, I didn't realize on the personal side, like you don't like to pound like I do. And I go 80 hours a week and I'm jealous that you only go 40 and you respect your time and your, and now like we just see differently on how we spend our personal time. We're now in conflict. So it's both. It's knowing how to look at both. Cause I've always said, hey, as long as the vision, the mission's the same and the core values are the same, it's a good first kind of checkbox. But you're saying just look at it on the personal side and the business side separately and make sure they're both in check. Is that fair to say?
So it's not exactly what I was intending, which I'll clarify in a second, but nonetheless, exactly what you bring up is essential. Like part of what you're talking about is the degree of sacrifice, mm-hmm. right? And so how I spend my personal time, let's say you and I are in business, let's say I like to golf, which I don't, but like, let's just pretend that I have that skill set. You may like to, in your spare time, use that to like be doing those monotonous tasks, like checking off emails or you know, moving stuff around in Asana or whatever the case may be. And that's how you experience some meaning and purpose that then allows you to extract even more value from the time that you're working. If we don't have that same degree of sacrifice and buy-in, we're not both putting in 80 hours a week. That is ripe for conflict from the very beginning. It's a big misalignment. I see it all the time. And so I agree that actually it goes beyond just having a business agreement. We need to also understand those broader life perspectives of, you know, where does this rank in terms of your priorities personally? You know, do you have a wife and family and kids that you need to see? Or are you the you know, kind of the only person in your domain and you're squarely focused on this. It's the most important thing in your life. Those are different.
The other big one I've actually seen is one person is financially kind of independent in the sense that they don't need the business's cash flow to provide for their lifestyle. The other person actually needs to pull money every month to be able to pay for their life. And that alone creates a different risk profile. And then suddenly the two of them are fighting about whether to store money for the future and development and growth. And the other one's like, no, we need to pull. It's because I need to. And it's because it's a personal thing. It has nothing to do with their goals. It's how they have to go and make sure they can pay the bills. That's a big one too. I don't know if any other ones like this you've seen early on. That's like, it's good to get this out in the open.
Yeah, you're hit again. This is a super important one. I talk about this broadly within the idea of what is the ideal exit, right? Okay. So like if we have misaligned visions on like, is this just and this, I'm going to use like some flippant terms that people are familiar with, but is this a lifestyle business where we can have high cash flow, live a good work-life balance, and like that is the optimal outcome? Or is this something that we're trying to really blow up and sell? Because again, that impacts how we manage capital, our risk tolerances, et cetera. Like, and if we don't have that conversation early, then we risk achieving neither, right? And like, that would be the worst of both worlds.
Is there any other big questions you wish people would ask before going into business together? Any other just like obvious ones? There's probably many, but like, is there any other big ones you just see as themes?
Questions in terms of like what I wish people would ask?
Yeah, or conversations you wish were had prior, things that you wish were established or understood. Alignment, where you see the misalignment later, you get in when the mess happens. So like if you could rewind the tape on some of these, it's like, I always see this. And if only in the beginning they had talked about X instead, or any of the other big themes that you see.
Yeah. So let's assume that they've had that long-term vision conversation like we were just discussing. Mm-hmm. The others that I think would be important are kind of values, decision-making styles. You know, there's some people where they want to rely on hierarchy, which is fine if everybody's in alignment, that's the way that we're going to make decisions. Other people like consensus-based. And so kind of, again, knowing these preferences, being really explicit about that early on can be helpful. I think also another big one that most people don't talk about is how to handle stress and disagreement and power dynamics.
I want to get into that. I want to get into one you just mentioned, which is decision making and how management is done. So I've even seen this where, you know, I'm a little bit more of like a mother hen. It's like we all work together and it's like through consensus. My business partner is a little bit more like strict to management and hierarchy and like structured roles. And I'm noticing how one has to be in and not the other. And it was actually okay when we were smaller and we were doing our own little things. Now there has to be a decision which management structure is going to lead the company. How often does this come up? How do you resolve that type of decision-making matrix? And how do business owners come to a resolution to this type of stuff?
I think, yeah, it happens all the time. And especially at moments of growth or inflection, whenever there needs to be a change in like the org chart, right? Or the structure and systems of an organization. And so in moments like that, that's also getting into kind of a one-door versus like a two-door decision, like using the Jeff Bezos kind of framework. Like one way door being, you know, we make this and there's no reversibility. Like we're committed to it. Two door being like, right, it's a revolving situation. We can make the decision and also undo it. I think for situations like that where it's table stakes and exceptionally important, that's the type of thing where I think having a really clear agreement about keeping it consensus-based could be beneficial. But I think part of what's challenging about like what you just mentioned is it makes me want to go back previously and better understand what were the agreements around decision making previously, and then have an explicit conversation of as a group, do we want to adhere to what we agreed upon previously, or is this a moment that we all need to make a change?
I listened to you previously talk about this one door versus two door decision making. I really liked it actually, and it's a personal note that I took. How do you determine what is a one-door decision versus a two-door decision? And can you do that early on? Or is that something you need to do more organically as the business grows?
I'm honestly not sure if there's like a super clear matrix. I mean, so there, I have like some of this already typed out. And of course, you can kind of read what Jeff Bezos wrote about it in kind of a memo to the company. But I think the way that I work, and this is my bias to be clear, but I think having those conversations about like this debate, I don't think I should be the one to answer what is a one door or, you know, kind of a two door type of decision. But I think as a team, having that conversation can be exceptionally beneficial. Because then you can also set expectations. Like, here's something that we know is like an existential. There's no coming back from this. And these are the types of conversations that I know, because we're kind of at the co-founder level, that's a co-founder level discussion. Here's some that are important, but that could be reversible, that don't have an existential level impact. And there we might rely on domain expertise or those roles and responsibilities, the org chart kind of more traditionally, where, you know, we don't need 100% alignment. You can kind of run your domain and then check in about it and give us updates as things progress. But
it's good. It's like a simplified decision-making matrix. Cause I know I've worked within that a little bit, and even that can sometimes be a little bit complicated, but it's just kind of like, this is a one door, which is like, we can only go through it and we can't go back, or is it a two door? We can go through it and come back. So there's less risk associated to it. Let's decide what those are. And then what I've noticed is early on that type of agreement matters, but as the company evolves 3 to 4 years in, that needs to be revisited. And there's more weight in a lot of the things that are going on in an organization. And it needs to be, I don't know if it's annually or I imagine every 3 to 4 years, this type of stuff needs to be looked at again, but fair enough.
To your point, I want to piggyback on that for sure. A second. Part of what's so important is regardless of where you start, because we already mentioned briefly a couple different areas where we might assume that someone's too similar. Like already we're sharing a lot of background context because we're friends and we did this, or other areas where we discover, oh, actually this person's not who I thought. The thing that's important, regardless of what happens in the very early stages, is the ability to change agreements over time. Mm-hmm. To be flexible, to update, you know, like whether it's an unspoken expectation or something that we explicitly agreed upon. Like, let's say you and I agree, we're both going to work 80 hours a week and we're completely aligned in that. But then, you know, as things happen in the business and personally, then we need to be able to re-update that agreement with some flexibility. And of course, if that requires changing compensation, equity, titles, like whatever, we need to be able to do that, because the dis-ease is not having the conflict conversation. Yeah. What we need to do, conflict is a call to action. So we need to be able to act upon it in order to realign as a team and make sure that we can continue scaling together. Because if we avoid the conflict conversation, that's whenever these rigid, outdated models start to really eat away at our productivity.
It's interesting, the word conflict. I think a lot of people see it as a negative connotation, whereas I went through conflict management course. It was just a simple one for 3 days. But the first thing they pointed out is conflict is a positive thing. And here's why you should need to see it this way. I was like, what? I thought it was about fighting. But it's actually about respecting yourself and the other person and finding common ground and getting into those conversations. So that's good. I'm curious because, I've listened to you on other podcasts, and there is deeper, I think, dynamics that go on as time progresses that underlines some conflicts that we just even named right now. What are some of the deeper dynamics amongst owners that you see that are fueling some of these conflicts in businesses?
I think maybe the best way to talk about this is to share just a new way of thinking about communication and some of these dynamics more generally, and then I can get more specific. So part of what I talk about in my book, The Co-Founder Effect, is that there's three languages that all teams speak, often unknowingly. There's operational, psychological, and archetypal. Operational language is the language of business. This is the default language that most teams use. It's rapid. It's kind of quick back and forth. It's not super cognitively demanding. And this is the language you're using whenever you're talking about KPIs, product roadmap, you know, like whatever the case may be. And by the way, most teams can be even more explicit about this language. There's a lot of implicit assumptions that I think create some inefficiencies. But generally speaking, this is a strength of most teams. Psychological language is the language of emotion. It's internally, how am I feeling? Internally, how are you feeling? And interpersonally, how are we feeling as we're working together? This, to be effective, requires more energy, more time, a little bit more spaciousness, more curiosity, leaning into a different part of our mode of operating where we're trying to feel understood and help someone else feel understood as well. Most teams don't do this super well. And then archetypal language is the language of the unconscious. This is the vibe. In psychoanalysis, it's called intersubjectivity. And so the vibe is basically that sense that you get whenever you're part of, like, let's use a positive sense, a high functioning team where there's complete alignment on the goals, on the methods to get there, and everyone's putting in the same amount of effort. That type of teamwork feels contagious. It feels like a flow state. It feels really exciting to be part of a team like that. There's a lot of aliveness. That's like a kind of a positive vibe. A negative vibe is that walking on eggshells, that like dread or discomfort or maybe some anxiety as you see that Slack message coming from your partner. all of those kind of negative vibes are telling you something about the state and the health of the partnership, of the relationship, of the team that you're on. And so the reason that I bring this up is operationally, we could be arguing about any number of things. We could be arguing about roles and responsibilities, equity and compensation, you know, hiring and firing dynamics, like you name it. We have many different categories there. But if it's a repetitive argument that continues and we feel like we can't make progress on it, 9 times out of 10, it's because there's something under that tip of the iceberg that's actually causing the issue. And so some of those issues within psychological language and archetypal language can be things like power, where I feel like I want more of a say than I currently have. It could be things like closeness, like maybe I feel like you're stepping on my toes. So we're arguing about roles and responsibilities, but what I'm really talking about is I feel like you're suffocating me and I need space in this relationship in order to perform my best. It could be things like recognition, where I feel like I want my contribution to be really seen and appreciated. And I don't. I feel like it's dismissed and downplayed. And so part of what I think our job is as co-founder coaches and just as entrepreneurs generally is to recognize when we're not using the correct language to solve the problem. Because if we're stuck on that operational language and again going in circles, it's a call to go down to try to either name that elephant in the room of the archetypal dynamic or to have a psychological conversation about some of these dynamics that are actually occurring under the surface.
Dude, I've seen this so much and I've personally felt this where what you just named is the repeating argument. It's like the biggest thing that I recognize and see. It's like, how do you identify it? It's when that argument comes up every other conversation and it drags on to the point where it actually takes away from what was that original meeting's purpose, which was to get the decision made about something that's business related or operationally related, right? And then suddenly it hijacks the whole conversation. So you're saying when that repeat thing keeps coming up, you need to stop having that conversation around the operational stuff and start to realize there's a deeper layer that needs to be addressed. Is that what you're saying?
That's exactly right. Okay. Because part of what's happening under the surface are those power struggles, unmet emotional needs. And just to like even take this to another extreme, because you brought this up earlier, that you mentioned the similarities between this relationship and marriage. Mm-hmm. At the root, the reason it's so similar is because of attachment. So it's an attachment-based relationship, meaning when you go through hard with somebody, you want to rely on them. You want to trust that they're going to show up for you, that they're going to be reliable, available, and responsive. And if they're not, if and when they're not, to like a business issue that's coming in, let's say, that feels frustrating. And it generates anxiety because it's like, if I can't trust and rely on you to show up and treat this seriously, then my livelihood is at stake. And so that's the degree of seriousness where some of these patterns can really play out. And so that's why so many of these different tools and frameworks from couples therapy modalities is relevant within this context.
So let's talk about this a bit. Let's talk about navigating these conflicts, because I feel like what you just named is for me anyways, pretty easy to identify. I'm like, when we repeat these conversations more than 3 times, we should probably do X, which is navigate a conflict. Can you walk us through how to do this properly? Because if it's just in the heat of the moment, all right, well, let's talk about this, then it's probably going to go terrible. So what do we do? How do we get to the root and actually start to work through the core issue?
So in the book, I go through a lot of detail on the co-founder conflict navigation system. And so the entire purpose of me writing this methodology really clearly is so that you can go through preparing for the conversation, how to have it, and then what to do afterwards. And so because, you know, we have to have some accountability here too. And so without going into all the details, I think part of what is most important, one kind of tool and framework that I really like to talk about is containing conflict. Because if you don't contain conflict, it will contaminate your execution. Let me give you an example.
Sure.
Let's say that me and my hypothetical business partner, Mark interrupts me 3 times in an all hands meeting. And, you know, under the surface, I'm feeling a little hurt, but, you know, I'm frankly just angry. And so I'll express that as frustration. So I'm angry. And if we don't contain it, it can look a lot like what you just said. Okay. Like as soon as it's over, I slam the computer down. I'm like, Mark, like, why are you such an asshole? Like you cut me off. You clearly don't care what I have to say. It's exceptionally frustrating. I'm raising my voice. I'm getting heated. All that does is create a net inefficiency in the communication, because now Mark has to defend his position and defend his reality. He has to say, Matt, like, no, like I do care about what you have to say. And wait, you're calling me like now I feel frustrated. And so again, it can explode. So it's contaminating our ability to stay focused and present.
Can I say something? There's something, tell me how this pertains to this, but I have this motto in my head. I don't know where it came from, but it's always like, Danny, you can either walk away and feel right, or you can fix the problem, but you can't have both. Is that a, like, I don't know, is that a, I don't even know where it came from, but I just remember like I get into that mode where I'm like, we got to fight. And that's me being like, oh, I got to be right is what my brain is telling me. And then what you're saying is like, hey, you can have that if you want, but you're not going to fix the problem. So if you want to fix the problem, you actually have to let go of that and start to like do what we're about to talk about, which is like get into the conflict problem. Is that a fair way to look at it? That's how I've always like looked at it.
I really dig that.
Yeah, I have to like call myself out a little bit because the emotional side of me is just like, I'm going to get right. I'm going to show them. And it's like, chill the fuck out. Just like, sorry.
That's, yeah. I mean, you're bringing up something so important. Like whenever you feel that drive mm-hmm. of like, I got to be right. I got to get my point across. There is an element where I think part of you needs to feel heard and understood. And so that is a valid emotional experience. And it is a clear sign in your case where it's like, let me regulate, let me get grounded, let me like clear my head a little bit and then approach this in a more productive manner.
Yeah. So how do we do that? How do we approach this in a more productive manner? Walk me through some of these steps.
Yeah. So to stick back with what I was talking about, the whole way to contain a conflict, I'm going to give you a very tactical way so sure. that this isn't, you know, some just esoteric stuff. So like, again, Mark interrupted me 3 times in the all hand. Either I chew him out right there because I want to be right. I want to feel heard. And again, that's going to be a net negative. Or another thing I can do is contain it by saying something like, hey, Mark, listen, man, I'm having a lot of feelings about in reactions to that all hands. I would love to just debug and realign with you. Are you game to sync Friday at 2 p.m.? So now Mark understands, okay, Matt wants to talk about what just happened. He has some thoughts and feelings about it, aka psychological language. And Friday at 2 p.m., I can agree or not agree. We schedule it for an hour and then we stick to an hour. So by doing that, we've contained the conflict. And so now it can be far more productive. One, it's going to give me a little bit of time and space. So I can come a little bit more prepared. And then two, it's not going to be as heated. And three, it is contained to this specific time. And so that way we can make it productive. So then I can have the conversation, to your point, leading with an iMessage, and I'll get into some of this momentarily, in a way that then can be both help me feel heard and understood more effectively and have Mark receive the feedback that he needs to receive as a leader, and then let the two of us be on the same page moving forward.
And is it fair to say that, like, I have maybe a more like aggressive personality, there's others that have more passive personalities, but it's challenging for both parties to do that, because I could see on my end having the mental wherewithal to slow my brain down enough to actually present that as an idea. But the presentation of it is probably that hard. But for others, I could see how it'd be hard for them to even have the balls to like ask for that and say, could we actually have a conflict on a certain day and actually speak up? But it's still hard on either side. It's just a different challenge.
100%. Yeah, I was on a call today with a leader of a startup company who had a lot of concerns about raising a difficult conversation with a colleague, and in their world wanted to just kind of circumvent the person, which I view as kind of something that's actually quite negative for the individual who needs the feedback directly, and can further isolate them and create even more negative secondary effects. And so as we leaned into this discomfort, what we discovered was that at root, the fear was like, oh, I don't want to like speak out of place. I don't want to make this worse. But again, conflict is a call to action. And so part of what was remembered in this conversation was, oh, it is my responsibility to call out some of the dynamics that I'm seeing. And I owe it to the person, because if I was in their shoes, it would be really important and valuable for me to get that process. And ultimately, this doesn't have to be some scary conflict conversation that's going to be horrible. In fact, I can unite and draw attention to the fact that we're on the same team here. We want the same outcome. We want this to be a fantastic company and product. And so part of how I can present it is in that light of, hey, I really want to make sure that we're in sync so that this doesn't happen again. And then kind of that being your segue.
So we've had the conversation. We said, hey, not in today's meeting, but let's set a time and place for this and make sure there's a purpose behind that meeting, which is to have this proper conflict then. What do we do next? What's after that? How am I preparing? Am I like, how are we, what are the next steps?
I think there's, if I could just give one bullet point about preparation, I would say sorting through what happened. So kind of doing a little retro. And then in particular, trying to write down and pay attention to the shared observable reality that both you, the other person, and a third party like myself could all agree actually occurred. And then the last piece, and I would love to get into a meta framework as to why this is so important. But the third piece that I would add is noticing your contribution. So trying to take ownership of how did I contribute? What, and again, even if it's 2%, what's the 2% that I can own that contributed to this outcome? And I think if you can do those three things, then it's really going to help you formulate the feedback in an effective manner.
Yeah. So you're reflecting in an objective. You're trying to bring objectivity when the emotions are lower. Versus when you're high in emotion, you're usually low in intelligence. So you're giving yourself space to do that, and you're writing that down objectively to reference, maybe even during this next conversation when you get into it. Is that kind of what you're saying?
That's right. And the reason is because in any conflict or disagreement, especially between two people, there's three different realities at play. There is your internal thoughts, feelings, reactions, your intent for why you did a thing. There's the other person's internal thoughts, feelings, reactions, their reality, how they were impacted by the thing. And then there's this net that separates those two realities. And in effect is a third reality that is a shared observable piece that everybody can agree actually happened. And the problem with conflict that's avoided is those, there's not much middle ground. We end up actually constructing our own reality because as human beings, not only are our memories not that great and accurate, but we also tell ourselves a lot of self-serving narratives. So in this example that I mentioned earlier with my fictitious co-founder, Mark, I might tell myself this story that he doesn't care about what I have to say. And all of a sudden that story becomes a reality. Okay. But that's me crossing the net, making an assumption about what's going on in his head that's totally inaccurate. And so part of what's so important as we then take some of this early material that you just talked about with the preparation into the conversation is using that old school I message, which helps you stay on your side of the net, roots it in your internal subjectivity and the shared observable reality, rather than crossing over into theirs that's going to make them more defensive. And saying like, hey, I felt hurt and frustrated whenever you interrupted me those three times, shared observable reality. And the reason that this is so important to me is because I really want to make sure that we have an alignment whenever we're presenting to the rest of the team. I want us to come across as a united front. I think that communication is so much clearer than that rushed one where I wanted to be right earlier. And that's part of, I think, some of the best practices as we get into how to have the conversation.
Okay. So we've written down some notes. We've gathered how we're feeling. We've gathered what's important. We've tried to bring some objectivity to our thoughts, although it is still subjective. You can't get perfect, but you're giving some effort to it. How do you enter this conversation? How is this conversation structured?
So I'll say it depends. If temperatures are low, I think you can kind of jump right in with what I was saying of like, you might set a little context first of like, you know, what was going on. And then you might then anchor it in the I message. And then also explore with the other person, like, you know, what was your experience like? And there could be like some free flowing dialogue to co-construct and make sense of what happened. When temperatures get higher, so like, let's say that actually this is not the first time this has happened. And let's say I ignored the conflict previously. And so this is actually hitting on a sore spot for me. So I'm actually really ticked off at Mark at this point. And let's say he also, vice versa, has some frustration toward me. If the temperature is higher, I like to add a tool called reflective dialogue. Reflective dialogue, I take from Imago Couples Therapy. And the thing that it does really well, and something that I really enjoy that they mentioned, they said, this is the long road that makes the whole trip shorter.
Okay.
And the reason they say this is because it basically divides the roles in the conversation to a speaker and a listener. And the speaker is going to focus on those best practices I mentioned, staying on your side of the net, using iMessages, grounding it in that shared observable reality piece. And then the listener, the person who's just kind of paying attention, is going to listen with the intent of helping the speaker feel understood.
Right.
So often in session where I'm working with co-founding teams, the person who's listening will take notes, and then their job is to reflect back what they heard. So they'll say, okay, you know, Matt, I heard you say XYZ. Did I get that right? And they'll paraphrase it back. And then the other person will say, yes. Okay. And then you can progress from there.
Going back to my conflict training back when I was really 20 years old, it was like, seek first to understand, then seek to be understood. That was the saying that it's like still burned in my skull to this day. And it's so hard to do. It's just so hard to do because you listen with the intent to respond, not the intent to listen, right? Especially like you said, when you're heated. Can owners honestly do this without help? Because I feel like one owner could come in super intentional to do this. How do you get the other owner to also play ball in this way? Do you send them a report? Do you send them a video? Obviously, you can work with you. How do you get the other person to also come in with that way of being if they don't understand that. Like they're going to come in with an intent to listen and respond and argue. How do you prepare both parties? Maybe send them this podcast. I don't know, but like,
it's such a good question. I think I have the benefit of having already multiple conversations with people before we start doing this type of work. So there's already a little trust and buy-in, but to your, I mean, it's a real important question because I think for a lot of business owners, there's this mentality that some of these, the extra effort and time put into a conversation like this is inefficient or isn't the best use of time, or it's not the, you know, the thing that's generating revenue. And so the challenge though, is like that the thing that I mentioned about, you know, this is the long road that makes the whole trip shorter. The reason why that's true is when we continue arguing about the same thing over and over again, what's wasting more time? The prep to have this challenging conversation together, or it's avoidance? I actually think easily it's the avoidance. And the avoidance actually increases emotional debt, which, just as a brief aside, part of what I often see is these small interactions between people that lead to hurt, frustration, whatever the emotion is. And basically, if we don't address it, it calcifies into resentment. And that resentment acts like termites to the house's foundation here. And so if we're not able to pay that debt down fast enough, it can really have catastrophic existential level effects on the company. And so I say all of that because I think getting back to the actual conversation here, pointing out the ways in which this is actually a net positive for the business, for someone who's more business oriented, can be really helpful to help them reframe the value of sitting and trying to listen to help the other person feel understood rather than just listening to respond.
Right. You get very practical with them. You just say, hey, look, this is costing us the XYZ time and decision making. Here's a framework that I think could help. Can you please play ball so we can actually move forward? And it's like, whether you love it or hate it, can we try this please together? And it's like, get very real and upfront about it basically. And practical.
Exactly.
Okay.
Yes.
What is the goal of this? Like, how do you know when you're done having this conversation? Because, you know, you listen to them, then you respond with how you're feeling, and then you get to a point where what are you trying to achieve in these conversations?
So I'll stick with the framework and then try to answer it. So sure. Within this framework of reflective dialogue, you will eventually switch roles. So at first you work to have the speaker feel completely heard and ideally understood, to where they feel like, oh yeah, this person gets it. And so in addition to reflecting back after you've done that a couple of rounds, I think optimal mode is to then not only just reflect, but then to add some statements of empathy or validation. Like, yeah, that makes sense. That's the lowest hanging fruit. It has nothing to do with, it doesn't validate your reality to be like, yeah, that makes sense from your perspective. Totally get why you perceive it that way. You can do stuff like that. You can talk about, yeah, like I could imagine that being really frustrating and difficult, and like getting into a little bit more of those emotional words, psychological language that will help them feel understood. And then you switch. And so then that's whenever, you know, the person who is listening has the full floor to kind of respond to anything that was raised, et cetera. And we continue that process. In an ideal world, I think what naturally happens in a conversation like this, because it's so radically different from the operational language that we spend so much time doing, is there's a sense of, especially once it's true, that you actually feel heard, you actually feel understood, the shoulders drop. There's like an ease kind of that comes over. Okay, like this isn't a 10 out of 10 anymore. I feel like we're at a 5 or 6, we can have this conversation. We don't need the structure now. We can like open up a little bit. You can like sense some of the shifts that can take place. So I think the goal is to get to that point. Right. Now, that point might require multiple conversations. And I would, just as a brief aside, prefer that you reschedule multiple sessions as opposed to letting that 1 hour bleed into 3. I don't think that's going to be positive.
Okay.
But I think if you can be like, okay, we're at this point, I think that's what you want to get to.
It's kind of like seek first to understand, validate what you're hearing, then seek to be understood, be validated. And the one thing I remember that I was taught years ago was don't seek to solve the problem, but seek to find common ground. And is that maybe like the principle? I don't know if you've heard of that before, but for me, it was like, I just want to make sure that, you said the shoulders go down and the defensiveness, the red tape goes away. I feel like that comes when it's like, you know what, man, at some point, like both of us kind of want the same thing over here. We both are trying to achieve productivity, or we're both trying to, maybe we're approaching it and we fully are still disagreed on how we do that, but at least we both realize we want the same thing. Is that kind of the shoulder go down moment?
I think so. I think that's part of it. I think part of it is the feeling heard and understood, therefore I don't need to defend. And especially to your point about finding common ground in business, in the teams that I see who are able to leverage conflict to be a net positive for the business, that shared aspiration, the shared goal comes through so much. And so if you can continually re-anchor in that, I think that does help make the conflicts and difficult moments more tolerable.
So we don't have to go over and over into this, but what is the repeat of this? How quickly and how often are you coming back to this conversation? How much time are you putting into this? Because I, like you said, it doesn't always just happen in one-hour conversation, and it shouldn't be in one long three-hour conversation. So is this usually like a two or a three or a four thing? Or what if I've been doing this for 2 years and we keep coming? Like, am I obviously doing something wrong? How do I make sure this is done and we get some resolution at some point? How long does this take? And what do I need to do that well?
I don't have a great answer. I think it varies so much based on what the topic of conversation is. And part of what we might be getting into is, as you asked the question, is what Gottman terms gridlock issues, which means that because we're two different people, the way that we come together, there's always going to be some friction and recurring arguments that will come up again and again, just because we're different people. And so part of what can be important is trying to get more efficient at having these conversations to smooth things over, to realign, and knowing like that is part of any long-term relationship.
Yeah, I can imagine it's kind of, and I've seen this actually with my own business partnership, but it's like once you've done a good job of it once, you can kind of say, hey, can we go have a conflict now? And they know what it means and you know what it means. And you can follow that framework a few more times, a little quicker and more effectively. Cool. I wanted to ask, I was just so interested, the things that I see that cause very different types of brains that work together often. I want to ask some unique situations, if there's anything, how to navigate these things differently, maybe it's the exact same or just unique situations that you've seen in stories of this. But the first one I want to bring up was the visionary and integrator relationship, because I find that that makes for such magic in a business when you can get those two working together well. I have that as well in my business partnership. How do you handle conflict between these two opposing forces? Because they do think so differently. And is there anything unique that you can bring up or even just circumstances around this?
There's a lot that comes up as you ask the question. I think one thing that's fascinating about kind of this like EOS system is where they end up landing with the visionary and the integrator is something that from a psychological and psychodynamic perspective, mapped onto personality styles and ways that people exist. So to use the clinical language just for a second, because again, we all have personality styles. And so I'm going to use some language that without the context of the psychology sounds like pejorative or whatever, which is not intentional. The visionary is psychologically most maps onto a narcissistic personality style and structure. The integrator, ideally, I think, would be more of a obsessive compulsive, so detail systems process. And the reason I bring this up is because part of those inherent differences create tensions, because they do, like, these personalities see the world so differently, operate really differently. But the beauty and the magic of getting that partnership right is this synergistic outcome where one plus one equals five.
Yeah.
Right. So it's like at its core, if you're able to really do this, I think it's fantastic. The example that came to mind though, that was a little bit more challenging is I've seen people try to implement this where it's not their personalities, where actually those roles do not map onto their personal strengths and styles and ways of relating. And that creates so much more friction for the partnership and individuals involved. And so I think part of what's so important about these are making sure as we step into those roles, is this really reflective of how we operate at our core? Is this a natural part of our way of being and how we think about the world, et cetera, or not? In which case, this might not be the best model for us.
You're saying some people just identify as the visionary or the integrator, even though they're not, but they just take the label on real quick. And then it's a completely different dynamic.
Yeah. Or someone who's like, I think that's probably the best way of saying it. And so like, for example, if like a true quote unquote visionary, so like, what, like someone, I call this person a validation seeking visionary, which is a nicer way than kind of the narcissistic label. For someone who's truly like that, to then, if let's just say in the partnership, there were two people with those same types of personalities,
okay, yeah,
and one of them has to take the integrator role, then all of a sudden, actually that's outside of their zone of genius is another way of saying it.
Yeah.
That's not how they naturally orient to the world. And so it's like, I've seen some brilliant people. I do not work in this way, just to be clear. Like, there's no way that I'm going to be that detail-oriented, process-oriented person. And so if you put me in that role, I'm going to underperform. And then the partnership is not going to unlock the true ceiling of a synergistic outcome in that capacity.
Right. So you're just saying, be real about who you actually are. And if you've mislabeled yourself or your partner, start to work through that first, because the biggest damage can be done by just trying to put somebody into a square, what was it, square peg, round hole kind of thing. Is that what you mean?
I think that's well articulated.
Okay. Family and friends. this is, I've worked with my friends in the past. I've worked with a family. No, I've actually not, I've not allowed my wife to work with me for a lot of reasons, but in general, a lot of us often will work with our spouse, or we might have a partnership with a friend that we started because when we were younger, it was awesome. We worked together. How do you work through some of these? Is there any unique dynamics here that you see?
Oh, 100%. I'll just, one broad point that I think is fascinating. Noam Wasserman wrote a book called The Founder's Dilemmas. And this is where a lot of people take that 65% of high potential startups fail due to co-founder conflict. This is the book where they kind of take that stat from. The thing that's so fascinating is as it pertains to companies who are founded by friends and family compared to other populations, what he found was companies who are founded by friends and family are more unstable than teams founded by people who previously had no prior social relationship, people who didn't know each other. Mm-hmm. The theory here is because there's more of a catch 22. If I raise a difficult conversation related to someone's work performance, like let's say it is a husband and wife, if I critique my wife at work, that could spill over and then impact us at home. And then, you know, she's not feeling good. And, you know, it's like, and there is a spillover effect in that way where the work dynamics can impact things at home. This is part of what makes co-founder conflict something that is so challenging.
I hear it from my buddy who's just like, I lie in bed with my wife sometimes and we're talking business and it is just the least sexiest thing we could ever do in bed. And I'm just like, note taken. I wasn't my wife's name, but I'm just like, honey, out of all due respect, can we make sure we don't have you in the business? It's just, I think, and maybe it's arrogant saying this because I have not had my spouse work with me, but I find it can make the relationship, the personal relationship, the same or worse. Not very often does it make it better. Is that a fair statement? I don't know. Is that too arrogant to say that? Maybe I'm offending somebody by saying that, but I just find it adds a layer of complexity to an already complex thing. I'm trying to raise my kids with my wife. We're trying to work as a team and everything. And when you add the stress of the business to the whole thing, I just feel like it's not that it can't be done. It's done by so many different people. I just feel like it's one of the more challenging routes to take.
I personally agree with you. I have a bias, sample selection bias issue on my end where most people who I'm working with already have that degree of friction. So it's like confirming this hypothesis. To speak on behalf of the two percenters,
sure.
The thing that I would say is it can help you feel more deeply known because it's like seeing your spouse in a different light, in a different capacity, where especially if they're like effective, worked with a team a while ago, husband and wife, really successful company. And the thing that really came through in our work was their degree of admiration and appreciation of how this person operates, even though it's so different from them. Seeing them operate in this capacity, really, really leading teams was something that kind of added more fuel to the fire of like the passion of this is why I love you. And so I think there are instances where this can work, but to the overarching point, this is part of why Noam talks about it as playing with fire, because it's so challenging to navigate both of these relational dynamics. And it requires, I think, kind of separating them in the following way, where you need to make sure that just because you're working with your spouse and you have more interface, more visibility, more time with them, that doesn't mean that you abandon the personal element of going on dates or whatever the case may be. And so this applies for friends too. Like if you're not able to tend to the friendship and the business partnership and they require different inputs, that's whenever there can be more of instability, insecurity that leads to some of the conflict becoming more challenging over time.
Is it okay to actually have some level of compartmentalization? Like we are at work today doing the work with the roles and we need to do that. And that you're not my wife right now. And then like we are at home and we're not in business together. I'm here. We're here to take care of the kids and have a good, is that healthy? Or is that like, is that psychotic? I don't know.
It's not psychotic, but I will say it does. I mean, this is a big personality thing. Like there's some people where that comes really naturally. Mm. The problem I think is whenever it's applied too rigidly. Mm-hmm. So I've worked with business partners where it's like, you know, we're business partners and friends and oh, they're totally separate. But also like, as we get into it, they're not, yeah. They're fundamentally not, they are related. It's the same way with like business or emotion. Like, I'm not going to talk about feelings in business. Like, well, all right. Well, a lot of decisions actually come down to how we think and feel about this stuff together. And so I think there's a world in which, to your point, it can be exceptionally beneficial to be able to have some degree of separation. I think that could be healthy. Even, but if it becomes too rigid and too far apart, that's also not going to be beneficial.
Right. It's inhumane. You had mentioned this word earlier and I brought it up even in prep to you and you called me out a bit and said narcissism is actually overdiagnosed. So I agree with you on this. I still still want to ask the question though, how do you handle a partner who only sees their views or justifications? So we're talking about how to go through these conflicts and you're just hitting a brick wall. And I called it narcissism. You're saying, Danny, you're overdiagnosing it. But generally when you have a partner, which is like, they only see their way or the highway, how do you manage through that?
It's a really difficult situation. And I've seen several business partners in relationships like this. The biggest dilemma of working with someone with that degree of rigidity is it puts you into a position of either appeasing them or confronting them. And the confrontation doesn't go well, and appeasing them is sacrificing a part of yourself. And so it's kind of choosing between, like, ideally what I encourage is trying to figure out what that middle ground is. So you can pick your battles all you want, but ultimately, if you're constantly self-sacrificing, you're internalizing that resentment, you're building that emotional debt, 9 times out of 10, you'll be the one to end the partnership. Mm-hmm. Okay, so like that's one path. It might take longer, but that's one path. The conflict one, again, especially if we're genuinely talking about someone with a very strong personality style who's not willing to do any of their own self-work, et cetera, then in that case, those confrontations aren't going to go well either. It's going to blow up and it's just going to be a whole thing, and then you'll go back to their reality. So ideally, the middle ground is finding ways to share feedback in an effective manner that both kind of inflates them a little bit, but also gives them a little dose of that reality too. But ultimately, that's a very hard relationship that I don't see people sustaining long term.
Are you talking about a sandwich?
Yes, more or less.
You're good here. There's a bit of a problem here and you're good here. And let's just continue with the feedback. I think in those scenarios, especially those extreme ones, it's imperative to probably get outside help. I think it's probably important not to just take your own entrepreneur mind in this podcast and try and really navigate it. I think it's actually important for the sake of the organization to go and seek outside help. Cool. So next one, the exact opposite of this, a person who's naturally avoidant, someone who just avoids conflict like the plague. How do you work and handle with this person?
I think having some conversations about the utility of conflict. Like, I think there's, and this also goes to family upbringing and stuff, but I think sometimes there's a this false thought that if we avoid conflict, then that means we never disagree, and it means that we're healthy even. And in fact, that can actually be quite toxic. Like a disagreement in an ideal world creates synthesis. It creates something new that we wouldn't have got to had we not engaged in a little bit of dialogue and back and forth. And so with someone who's conflict avoidant, I think, let me just add an additional cycle here. One of the most common patterns, both in marriage and in business partners, is what kind of attachment folks call a pursue and withdraw relationship. This comes from Sue Johnson's work of emotion-focused couples therapy. A pursue and withdraw dynamic is where one person, let's just say, might be really critical and frustrated in the other. In this context, like work product isn't up to par, how they're communicating, like whatever the thing is. I feel really frustrated, and so I'm going to go and share this feedback and criticism. The other person in response feels unsafe, unheard, unvalued, like whatever some of those deeper things are. They choose to pull back. Well, I don't want to show you my work in a proactive way, especially when I don't feel appreciated. Like, this doesn't feel good. I'm going to pull back. And the problem with this loop is that it just keeps going and going and going. And so I bring it up because the solution is kind of obvious if you think about it, which is the person who's doing the pursuing, the criticism, actually has to soften a little bit, has to slow down, has to be able to voice this in a more approachable and digestible manner. And the person who's been withdrawing and pulling back needs to lean in a little bit and to be more proactive about what's happening in their heads. And so then a lot of the coaching is teaching both individuals how to do that. And so in a case like this, if you're working with someone who's more avoidant, I think it's trying to both normalize the importance of this and giving a little bit more time and space, because one of you also might be an internal processor, someone who thinks and arrives at their conclusion before feeling comfortable sharing it, where someone else might be more of the external processor and talks aloud to arrive at that same conclusion. And so minding those differences and finding ideally a middle ground can be really helpful.
Is it fair to say every single thing we've talked about today kind of revolves around the fact that to get through this, to do a better job of this, you need to increase self-awareness for you and your business partner and the people you work with? Because everything you're talking about right now is just like, just know who you are. Know who your business partner is and start to really understand those constructs so that you can work within them and not fumble around in the dark. And a little bit of self-awareness can go a long way versus years or months or weeks of arguing and going back and forth. And anyways, as I'm listening to you, I'm kind of like, if only they knew this about themselves, if only they knew, I'm like, yeah, it's like, we just need to become more self-aware, don't we? We're as entrepreneurs, we sometimes tend to be, because I think, especially as you go, I've been in business since I was 18 years old. And so you get a little bit of a stubborn way of operating where you're like, this is how I do things. This is who I am. This is what I know works. And I know I'm not 50 yet, right? But I'm on my way to get older and I'm starting to notice I'm becoming more stubborn. I'm becoming more single-minded, maybe is a good way to put it. And if I want to be successful in business, if I want to carry things forward and get to the next level, I need to work on my self-awareness, actually more even than when I was younger, because I think I had a little bit more openness when I didn't know anything. And now I've got these stubborn ideals that I stick to that are blocking me from growth. I don't know.
Yeah, No. You're onto something. I was just reflecting. I'm like, man, like I'm 36 and I'm starting to feel more rigid myself.
Yeah,
so
yeah,
what's
yeah.
40 going to look like? What's 50 going to look like? But no, I think like the piece around self-awareness is one that I would emphasize as an ongoing practice. Because again, the fascinating thing about people is we continue evolving and changing, as do businesses. And so it's not just like, oh, I have this insight about myself or my partner, therefore all good and I know exactly what to do. It's checking back in, because we need to continue updating the way that we think about ourselves and we think about the other person. Because if we're operating from an outdated model, that's also going to be ineffective. And so it's a process to cultivate. And to your other point, I think that we solve the problems that we know how to solve, right? And so if we feel like, oh, this is revenue generating, and I know how to solve it, I know how to do it, just put my head down and power forward, it's like that feels comfortable.
Yeah.
That gives you a sense of control. Leaning into some of these conversations and self-discovery in the way that I'm advocating for can feel, again, inefficient or scary, or like, oh man, I don't know if I really want to look at this part of myself. And so I think it does take some courage to confront these aspects of ourselves internally and interpersonally.
It's amazing. Good. Well, this, I think, hopefully will save one to many business partnerships, or at least steer them in the right direction. Hopefully this episode gives some good out. And if people want to go in deeper with you, because I imagine, Matt, this is not something you can just solve in a 1-hour podcast. So how do people reach out to you? How do people connect with you? You have an ebook that people can connect with. Maybe we should link it here in the description for everyone. How do people take the next step if this is ringing true for them?
Yeah. So if any of this sounds interesting, I do have a book called The Co-Founder Effect, How to Diagnose, Fix, and Scale Healthy Communication for Startup Success, that takes everything we've talked about today and 10x's it, far more depth, far more tactical elements to implement immediately. And so that's available on Amazon. You could also look at my website, cofounderclarity.com, and feel free to contact me there or matt@cofounderclarity.com. And I would love to hear from you.
And for everyone listening, who's just like, just give me one good step I could take from this. What would be one just good action item? They work with a business partner. What's it just a good best practice for everyone listening?
A good best practice that comes to mind that's just like low hanging fruit that you can implement on day one that will have a net positive ROI is really being a little bit more structured and intentional with your what I call syncs and dates. So syncs, this is that operational language that you're already doing, but again, making sure that you're kind of having this container that could be once a day, depending on stage of business, could be once a week, where we're running through the various business updates. I'm not going to spend much time on that, but I'm just recommending like, yes, like schedule that in the calendar. Don't just make it an ad hoc thing every day. Second piece is the co-founder dates. And I talk about this, I name it as dates just as an aside, because I had some co-founders years and years ago who said, Matt, it sounds like you're trying to get us to like date again. And I was like, you know what? Yeah, like in a way.
Right.
And so co-founder dates are all about meta communication, which is talking about how we are communicating together. Because again, this is where that self-awareness piece comes in. If we're able to better understand how we are working together, then we know what adjustments we can make to work more effectively together. It's the difference between working in your business and working on your business, right? I want you to work on your partnership. So let's step outside of it and analyze it and talk about it. So co-founder dates are all about that. And so this can be going on a long walk together. This can be going to the gym. Some teams like to play video games. It's doing something outside of work that allows you to connect with the human and humanizes the other person you're working with. And this is how you can update that internal model, also get some more positive interactions in there. And so the way that you do this is not only do you schedule some of those activities while you're doing them, the one piece that I would recommend is asking a question, which is, how are we doing? how are we working together, right? Like these we questions, so that then we can access that meta communication layer and talk about how we're communicating and then refine it. And if you do this, you know, so there's some teams who do this once a week for an hour. There's teams who do this once a quarter, whatever that is, figure out what that regular cadence ought to be in your case and then stick to it. I think if you do that from day one, you'll be preventing a lot of issues that tend to build up for teams.
Amazing and simple too. I feel like the syncs thing is kind of like, yeah, like for sure. Got to sync up on the decision making. Got to do the thing. The dates thing is kind of like, yeah, when we have time, versus like, no, it's just as important as the syncs. So great point.
I appreciate that emphasis. Yeah, because I think, again, it's very easy to dismiss because it doesn't feel as connected, doesn't feel as familiar.
You can go for dinner next week. Yet, it's fine.
Right. And yet it could be insanely valuable over time to compound that talking about your partnership rather than just reacting to it.
Yeah. And it's fun to feel like you're in battle with somebody, that you're in war together, that we're in the foxhole and there's bullets flying and together we got each other's backs. And it's hard when you're just like, was this guy going to shoot me in the back? Like, I can't even tell anymore. And so, yeah, syncs and dates. Let's go to war. Sweet Matt.
I mean, I think that's why it's the most important relationship in business, because if it goes well, you have that person by your side who has your back at all times. And if you're questioning if I'm going to get shot in the back, that's a problem, right? And so we want you to have the former experience and not the latter.
For sure. Okay. Anything else, Matt? Any final words of advice? Or
no, I don't think so.
We covered a lot.
I've enjoyed the conversation.
Yeah, likewise. Thanks for your time on this. I think this will help a lot of people listening. So we'll ship this out. We'll put a link so that people can access you or connect with you if they'd like. And again, thanks for your time.
Cool. Thank you.
Okay. See you, Dr. Matt Jones. Thanks so much for listening to this episode of Contractor Evolution. If you've already subscribed to our podcast, consider sharing this episode with another contractor that you think needs to hear it.